The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone.
Hi, Brian here, the integrated dentist. Today, I have the great privilege of interviewing Ocean Robbins, who is really one of my real heroes. The more research I looked into Ocean's life and his circumstances, the more I'm totally, totally in awe. It is my honour to be able to speak to him at this moment. Ocean, now, could you tell me how it all started? Because a lot of people don't understand, for example, how you've got such a strong relationship with your father.
Well, absolutely. I'd be happy to. We can actually go back a couple of generations. My grandfather founded an ice cream company called Baskin-Robbins with his brother-in-law, Bert Baskin. My grandpa's was Irvin Robbins, and it became the world's largest ice cream company. My dad, John, grew up with an ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in the backyard and 31 flavors of ice cream in the freezer, and he was groomed from childhood to one day join in running the family company. But when he was in his early 20s, he was offered that chance, and he said no. And he walked away from a path that was practically paved with gold and ice cream to, as we say in our family, follow his own rocky road. He ended up becoming a best-selling author, writing about food and health issues, inspiring millions of people to look at their food as a chance to make a difference in the world. And the media had a lot of fun with his story. They called him the rebel without a cone. And in a remarkable twist of fate, my grandpa wound up having serious health challenges in his early 70s and being given by his doctors a copy of my dad's best-selling book, Diet for New America, and they suggested he read it. Well, remarkably enough, my grandpa did. He changed his diet, and he got incredible results. He started eating a lot more vegetables. He gave up sugar. He gave up ice cream. And he started eating a lot less meat, and he lost 20 pounds. He got off all of his diabetes and high blood pressure medications. His golf game improved 7 strokes, and he added 18 more healthy, vibrant years to his life. And so in this remarkable journey of ours, we've seen within our own family the power that food can have to harm and also to heal. So I founded a nonprofit organization kind of inspired by my dad's leadership when I was 16 and worked with leaders all over the planet in 65 countries who were standing up for healthy people and a healthy planet. And as I traveled the globe and worked globally, I kept seeing that everybody eats and that what we eat is having this immense impact on our health and also on the health of the whole world around us. And so 5 years ago, I joined forces with my dad directly to launch the Food Revolution Network. And we are a network of about 500,000 people now who are standing up for healthy, sustainable, humane, and delicious food for everyone. So that's kind of the quick story. At another level, the story is a story of a time we live in which I think we're in kind of a time of crisis, where we have more people living chronically ill than ever. Every day on this planet, we have less topsoil, we have less water, and we have more people and more mouths to feed. And in that context, the insanity of an industrialized food system that is putting profits and greed over the health of people on the planet is not just concerning, but it can actually be lethal. We have 15 million people died last year worldwide from diet-fueled disease. And we can do so much better. Our lives are on the line, and it's time to eat like our lives depend on it, because they actually do. So I'm passionate about the work I do, and I love that I get to do it with my dad, and I love that I get to do it with so many people who care and are committed to being agents of change, because I think together we're actually creating what I call a food revolution.
Yes, I must admit, this is where I felt there was a lot of congruency between ourselves. I was inspired by Weston Price, Nutrition and Degeneration. Inspired me to write, in fact, two books where, in fact, I related it, being a dentist, to nutrition and dental health. But you cannot separate the two. What was interesting?
That's so true. I mean, there's this disconnect where we think that our health and our bodies are somehow not one and the same, right? But
absolutely,
what you eat literally becomes you. And, you know, food is the foundation of health. But unfortunately for many people, it's also the foundation of disease.
That's right. But I think that what I really appreciate what you're trying to do is you're trying to encompass everybody. So you're not trying to steer everybody into a very strict regime, but your coaching and your revolution is about making meaningful change. And you're using, as far as I can see, all the, what should we say, modern technology to be able to put this message across, where, say, in just writing books, you know, there's a limited audience. Here, you're making this available in a far more better format than ever in history we've been able to do.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the good news is that I think we've reached a tipping point where so many people are sick of being sick. They're fed up with toxic food. They've honestly lost trust in the industrialized food system, and they're hungry for a change. And so more and more people are interested in organically grown foods. They're interested in the U.S. where I live, in non-GMO foods. There, more and more people are interested in local foods, in foods that are fair trade. And quite frankly, food companies are having to make shorter ingredient lists now, because people are getting wary, rightfully so, of ingredients they don't know how to pronounce. And I think the trend is clear that that the days of food as purely a source of entertainment are numbered. We want food that nourishes us. We want food that helps us to thrive. We're not willing to compromise our health for short-term pleasure anymore. And more people are realizing that there's not a whole lot of fun in getting cancer, in forgetting the names of your loved ones because you have dementia, or for that matter, in having your teeth rot, as you discover and experience. And so so we have to think about the real pleasure that comes from enjoying delicious, healthy food that helps us thrive long term. When your cardiovascular system is working well, you have blood flow in your body, you have blood flow in your brain, you have more mental clarity. And I'm interested in helping more people thrive, not just survive. And that requires a reinvention of our food so that it serves health and it serves life.
Ocean, could you explain to those, especially in the UK and Europe, about GM, because there's a lot of confusion, because everyone thinks or that they understand that there's a problem here, but they don't understand quite about the difference between genetically modified foods and why this should be giving them some form of harm.
Absolutely. So first of all, what's a GMO? Some people think it means God move over, but it actually means genetically modified organism. And there's a rampant confusion because Monsanto and some of the other companies involved in this technology have tried to blur it and make it sound like hybridization or selective breeding are somehow the same as genetic engineering, but actually they're quite different. When you take, cross-pollinate, or you take your sweetest tomato and you use it to reproduce and make more tomatoes, you know, these are things that have been done by farmers for a long, long time. But when you splice the genes of a bacteria or a virus or a fish or a pig into, you know, the DNA of a plant, you are crossing the species barrier and you're creating something that's unprecedented. And so in a sense, it's a new life form. And it's on this basis that Monsanto and these other companies have patented GMOs, right? It's why they're able to make money off of selling them. Now, the GMO, the biotechnology industry, has promised the world that GMOs would bring us certain benefits. They've told us that they would bring us more drought-resistant crops, bigger yields, a higher nutritional profile, and lower pesticide consumption. But when you actually look at the facts and you look at what's happened so far, we've got a lot of acreage of GMOs around the world, especially in the United States. And so far, GMO crops have not brought any of those benefits. They have not brought an increase in yield. They have not brought us more drought resistance or lower water consumption. They haven't added any value of flavor or nutrition. And they have not brought us lower pesticide use. In fact, to the contrary, they have brought us increased pesticide use. So what are they giving us? Well, GM crops have two traits. 99% of the genetically engineered crops on the marketplace today have one or both of these traits. Number one, they are pesticide producers. This means they literally create an insecticide that's in every cell of the plant, so that bugs who take a bite of it will have their stomach split open and they die. We're talking about BT here. Now, BT has been used in organic agriculture for a long time. It's generally considered fairly safe for human consumption. But it used to be something that was put on judiciously to kill bugs and could be washed off. Now it's in every cell of the plant. Some of these plants are literally registered with the Environmental Protection Agency here in the U.S. as pesticides. They're living pesticide factories. And the other trait that we've got here is that they are herbicide resistant. This means that the field can be sprayed with herbicides like Roundup, whose active ingredient is glyphosate, made, of course, by Monsanto. They can be sprayed with herbicides, and the weeds will die, and the plants will not. Now, this is great from an big ag perspective when you can spray the field with from an airplane and then not have to actually weed it with human labor, so it saves some money. But on the downside, we are spraying toxic herbicides directly on foods that are eaten by human beings. Now, you couldn't have done that before because the plant would have died, but now we're spraying it directly on crops eaten by human beings, and we are learning every day more and more about how toxic these herbicides are. For example, glyphosate, which is made by Monsanto and is the active ingredient in Roundup, was recently declared by the World Health Organization to be a probable carcinogen. So we're spraying likely cancer-causing herbicides on foods grown by humans. And now we've got herbicide-resistant superweeds that are sprouting up that aren't killed by glyphosate. So now they've come out with the answer, which is making plants that are resistant to other herbicides, such as 2,4-D, which is one of the two active ingredients in a compound known as Agent Orange that was used during the Vietnam War. 2,4-D has been linked Agent Orange has been linked to millions of birth defects and cancer cases and Parkinson's and death. And we're now spraying a piece of this chemical concoction, 2,4-D, directly on crops, again, destined for human consumption. So, you know, what are the health impacts of GMOs? Well, we're not entirely sure. There's never been any long-term studies done of human beings consuming them. But we do know that they are being sprayed with herbicides that are toxic to humans. And we do know that they are producing insecticides and that they're not giving us any of the benefits that were promised. And that a few companies are making a lot of money as they now control over half of the world's seed supply, while they're generating and selling seeds that are tied to their specific patented herbicides. So if you ask me, we've got a system that's making money for a few companies, but a lot of people have very good reason to be concerned about their health, their environment's health, and the health of their families as we consume this stuff.
I find it amazing that the USA, I don't know if it actually went through, was the DARC Act, where, you know, food did not need to be labelled as GM or GMO. And to me, this seems an absolute sort of travesty of people being deprived of knowledge so they can make choices.
Yes, it did go through. We call it the Deny Americans Right to Know Act, or the DARC Act. So, you know, in Europe, of course, there is labeling of GMOs. And as a result, a lot of food companies prefer not to put that label on. And so there isn't nearly as much of it as there is in the United States. In the U.S., we've had no labeling. And then the DARC Act was pretending to be a labeling bill. But what it requires is eventually companies will need to label GMOs through a code that will be on the product package, that you'll need a smartphone to scan it and a special app. And then you can find out a lot of information about the product, including whether or not it contains GMOs. Now, from my perspective, this is ridiculous. Most of us don't walk around with smartphones scanning the barcodes of every product we purchase, right? We should just be to have companies just straight up tell us, and some will. Some companies are volunteering to label GMOs because they know that consumers should have this information so they can make informed choices. We also have a non-GMO certification program in the U.S., which did over $20 billion in sales last year to products that were certified non-GMO. It's called the Non-GMO Project. And so when companies put that label on, they get better results. I think the bottom line we're seeing in the United States is that going non-GMO is generally good for companies' sales. And having GMOs isn't so good, and consumers want to know, and consumers care. More than 90% of the U.S. public supports GMO labeling, which is one of the reasons why the passage of the so-called DARC Act is so disturbing. Now, I understand, of course, in Europe, you don't have nearly as high a prevalence of GMOs, but it's still an issue. And of course, our government in the U.S., I'm sorry to say, is constantly pushing European governments to allow more GMOs, and both to livestock and to humans. And as one American here who is opposed to this madness, let me just say to the folks listening right now, if you are concerned about this, you have every reason to be. And thank you for your stake in the ground in what the way you put it down there, to say, no, I don't want to support this. I don't want to buy it. I don't want to vote for it. I want a healthy, clean, safe food supply.
I must admit, most of the major supermarkets in the UK do have a large organic section. But there's still this problem of what I will call air miles and environmental issues, because we still import foods from all over the world. And some of these are organic, but then if they're then sprayed, I'm not sure that there's a huge advantage, because they've been, say, taken from Chile or anywhere else. What's your views over the sort of what I'll call distant food transferring?
Well, I think that there's a lot of value to eating locally when we can, and eating with the seasons when we can. You know, the fact that the average molecule of food is traveling a couple thousand miles from farm to dinner plate is concerning, and sometimes it means food's less fresh, and sometimes it means there's a carbon footprint to that. And you have to balance that, right? Not everybody lives in the tropics. Not everybody lives in a place where they can eat abundant, fresh, healthy, local food all the time, all year round. And so if you, you know, if you care about your health, then, and you live in a northern climate where there are long winters, then you probably want to bring in some vegetables and some fruits, because let's face it, you're going to be healthier if you do, right? And I don't think you're doing anybody a great service if you, you know, eat nothing but stored up grains and meat for 6 months of the year, because that's all that can grow in your community. So, you know, use your freezer and take advantage of the frozen foods, because studies are finding that, like, frozen blueberries and frozen vegetables preserve their antioxidants and their flavonoids and all the wonderful chemicals that make them so nutritious for the body. So enjoy, take advantage of that. I think that a certain amount of importing is necessary. I just think that in my ideal world, you know, we would focus more on local economies. Those of us who can support farmers markets or direct relationships with farmers. Some people have what we call community supported agriculture programs, where they actually buy direct from a farm, and the farm will, you know, give shares to their members. And every week they get the members get a certain portion of whatever the farm has grown that week. And it's a wonderful way to kind of share in the harvest. And if they get a big bumper crop of zucchinis, then guess what? You get a lot of zucchinis. And it's a great way to kind of eat with the season. So, you know, during the summer or during the months that that's available, I think those are wonderful things to try to buy local foods that grow in your community. But at the same time, like, absolutely take good care of yourself. And in one of the benefits of the modern world is that we do have access to a broad range of resources today that would have been unthinkable for past generations. So I have no real qualms about encouraging people to eat good, healthy, whole foods, even if some of them come from a ways away, while at the same time, of course, valuing local as much as possible.
Yes. I mean, the other big issue, which is relevant to dental health, but it's to health across the whole of the what I call civilized society, is that most of these health issues, which I believe is contributing from our diet, is often in our what I would call lower socioeconomic groups.
Yes.
And it seems to be that the argument is that it's a combination of saying that they buy the cheapest food, but also there appears to be very little education for them.
You know, I think that access to healthy food is one of the most significant social justice issues of our times. You know, around the world, you look at the statistics and you see that we have almost a billion people in the world who are chronically malnourished, who don't have enough calories to meet their basic needs. But we also have something over a billion people in the world who are obese or overweight in a significant way. And both of these groups, representing, you know, over 2.5 billion people today, are vastly disproportionately represented by low-income communities and often communities of color. And there are a number of reasons why this is the case. One is that when people are impoverished, if they can get enough calories to fill their belly, they're often going to be the cheapest calories. And the cheapest calories tend to be things like white flour, sugar, bottled oils, heavily processed foods. Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that processed foods don't tend to go bad per se, because they have preservatives or they are stripped of a lot of the nutrients that would actually make them appealing to bacteria. So they don't degrade. They have a long shelf life. But there's sometimes the saying that if it doesn't go bad, it's probably bad for you. So, you know, we want foods that are fresh, right, as a pretty big part of our diet. So that's one issue. Another issue is government subsidies. In many countries around the world, governments have various ways of subsidizing what are called commodities crops. In the U.S., for example, we subsidize corn and wheat and soy and in a pretty big way. And their government actually will basically do those subsidies, lower the price of those crops. It's a way of kind of trying to help farmers and, it's in theory, help basic caloric needs get met. But at the end of the day, what it's doing is it's bringing down the price of factory-farmed animal products with animals that are fed on corn and soy. It's bringing down the price of things like corn syrup or sugar or highly processed foods. And basically, it's kind of like we're being fined for wearing our seatbelts. If you want to take care of your body and do the right thing, you have to pay extra at the grocery store because vegetables are not subject to the same kinds of subsidies. And this is something that's a dynamic worldwide in most developed countries. This practice persists. And I think it's rather insane. But it especially impacts the poor, who can't afford to pay extra to do the right thing for their bodies. And then we've got issues of access. So a lot of times in inner city communities, as well as in very rural communities, which tend to be where the poorest populations live, there may not be a lot of grocery stores with good, healthy food. We tend to have more saturation of liquor stores and corner stores and less really abundant healthy markets. It seems that the natural foods type stores tend to do the best in the communities that are more affluent. But what this means is that for a lot of poor folks, they actually have to travel farther to access healthy food, which creates another barrier. And then, of course, we've got education, where people who are in survival mode, who are just trying to survive or make it through a day or feed their families, who may be working two jobs, for example, are not going to have as much space or time to really take care of themselves or to be learning a lot about the latest breaking insights around food and health. So it is, therefore, something of a privilege, I think, to have access to this information and the ability to apply it in life. And for those of us who have that privilege, I say let's use it and let's share it and spread it so that we can support more people having access to healthy food. We have kids today who are growing up fat, who are growing up with diabetes, who are growing up mentally sluggish or with ADD or struggling to even keep their minds engaged in their schoolwork. And they don't know that the foundation of their suffering is not their fault, it's their diet. And with what we know today, I think it is, honestly, it's kind of a form of child abuse to raise kids on junk food and set them up for a lifetime of disease. Now, I know a lot of people feed their kids, you know, the best way they know how. And I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I'm saying that as a society, I think we have a responsibility today, if we want to call ourselves civilized, to raise our children and to help our poorest and our most struggling communities in ways that support health and that support resiliency and that are an investment in the future. I think this will be one of the great measures of whether we can truly call ourselves civilized in the decades ahead.
Well, I know from looking at your biography that you've always been a person who's looked at things from a global perspective. You know, you really look like, at 6-7 years old, actually organizing a peace rally at your school. To me, you're like the Mozart of peace and health. Now, the reason I say that is because obviously it appears from what you're saying that your focus now is on trying to mend the world from a nutritional point of view. And I would tend to agree that if you are nutritionally balanced, then it's not just the benefits on a healthy body, but it's a healthy spirit and a healthy mind.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think that we were just meant to survive, although for a lot of people in the world, that's a noble goal. I think we were meant to thrive. I sometimes think that food 1.0 is what I call survival. In food 1.0, your goal is just to make it through. If you get enough calories to fill your belly and carry on for another day, then that's success. And I think that in food 2.0, the central organizing principle is commerce. It's about the buying and selling of goods. And it's brought us incredible flavors and tastes and cuisines and 31 flavors of ice cream and foods from all over the planet. But unfortunately, food 2.0 is morally bankrupt. And it's also brought us the most abundant but nutritionally inferior food supply in human history. And then I think we need to move to food 3.0, where I say the central organizing principle is health. It's health for our bodies and it's health for our planet. And, you know, there's plenty of profits to be made in food 3.0, but I think they come from healthy food. We can make healthy profits from healthy food. And that is my vision. That's where I see us going in our lives today. We're standing for a food revolution where everybody has access to safe, healthy, delicious, humane, and sustainable food. And that's what my life's about, Brian, honestly. At this point, that's the central thing I'm passionate about because I know what a difference it can make. And my heart breaks with all the people who are suffering when they don't need to be. And my heart fills with joy when I see people claim food as an opportunity to care for their bodies, to care for their health, and to love their life more than ever.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that I came across very recently was that one of the senior deans of the undergraduate medical universities actually admitted that because the levels of avoidable disease due to nutrition and lifestyle was at such an epidemic level that they may have to introduce, would you believe, at an undergraduate level, nutrition and lifestyle. Now, would you not believe that this would be the basic principles of an undergraduate doctor?
You would think so, would you not? But I can tell you that in the United States, less than a third of our medical schools have a single required course in nutrition. So in two-thirds of the cases, you know, someone can graduate medical school, become a practicing physician, and not have taken one course in nutrition. With all that we know about how food is the foundation of health, with all that we know about the fact that 20% of the deaths on the planet last year were caused by diet and lifestyle, yet we're digging our own graves with our knives and forks, day in and day out, and our medical professionals, for the most part, are trained in a system that acts like food didn't matter.
That's correct. And also, I can see that if you could mobilize the medical profession, who I believe are possibly some of the most gifted in terms of intelligence and ability to be able to mobilize your principles or at least understand them, then I think we would be looking at a revolution which would be from what I would call a greatly respected pillar of the community.
Yes. It's true. That's one of our actual goals. We are working with a number of organizations right now to launch a campaign aimed at encouraging the National Board of Medical Examiners in the U.S. to make food a central part of medical school curricula and to put nutrition on the tests that physicians that medical school students need to pass in order to become physicians. And of course, this is a global reality. We're just working in the U.S. because each country has its own policies. But the big picture is that we need doctors, we need insurance companies, we need the food industry to get on board if we're going to create the changes that we want today. It can't just be up to individuals to make a change. We need to do that, but there's so much more that we can do. And as a society, if we make it easier and easier for people to do the right thing, you shouldn't have to swim upstream in order to do the right thing and take care of your body. You know, we should have a society that makes it easier and easier for us to thrive and succeed. And so that's kind of what we're standing for and working towards. And I'm personally really optimistic because I think that the tides of history are on our side. I think that the masses of people are sick of being sick and are hungry for a change. And I think that, you know, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. You know, as much as there's money being made from a toxic food system, there's also a lot of money to be made in a healthy food system. And the savings are so tremendous in terms of medical costs, in terms of quality of life, in terms of even our academic performance. I mean, in terms of how smart kids are in school, in terms of the future of our societies, you know, we can save so much money. We can slash our rates of depression. We can slash our rates of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and even dementia. And we can increase the quality of life enjoyed by literally billions of people. And we can do all that while saving money. You know, what's not to like about this, really? and therefore, we were building a consensus of concerned citizens who are saying that a toxic food system needs to change. And the time for that change is now.
Fantastic. Ocean, what are your views on things such as nutritional supplements, especially when we're looking at a lot of the food that may well be deprived, even organic food, of less of the micronutrients, trace elements that were, say, around 100 years ago?
Well, I'm a big fan of getting as many of your nutrients as possible from food, because I think that's how nature intended it. And that the danger with supplements, of course, is that when you isolate a specific component, you sometimes find that you don't get the results you expected because nature exquisitely designed all the components to work together in harmony. So when you isolate a specific component, sometimes you find that the results aren't there in the way that was intended. And, you know, there actually are not a lot of studies showing supplements being beneficial. Some studies have shown that multivitamins are actually associated with negative health outcomes in terms of populations that take them for long periods of time. That said, there are a few supplements that I think make sense for a lot of people to take. And I'm specifically talking about, for anybody who's on a plant-based diet, vitamin B12 is one that should probably be taken every day or two. And then vitamin D3, for people who live in northern climates, it's very advantageous to consume vitamin D and D3 in particular. And there are quite a few studies that have shown positive health benefits, stronger immune system and cardiovascular function and many other benefits from vitamin D. And then, those are kind of the top two. And then turmeric is an herb that is associated with tremendous health benefits. And in fact, in India, where the rates of Alzheimer's disease are about 2% what they are in the U.S., for example, the population, you know, there could be a couple reasons for this. One is that they eat a very plant-strong diet. Over half the population of India is vegetarian. But also, they consume a tremendous amount of turmeric. And some people think this could be one of the key reasons. So turmeric root is really, really healthy for you. And some people choose to take a curcumin supplement, which is curcuminoids are the active ingredient in turmeric that we think makes it such a health-giving food. And so some people take a curcuminoid supplement, and I think that can be very beneficial as well. So those are a few of the supplements that I think can make sense widely. And then some people also find benefit in taking a source of omega-3 fatty acids if they don't consume fish in their diet. And because, you know, you can get omega-3s from certain sources like flax or chia seeds. But sometimes we need all three of the omega-3s, and DHA and EPA are two of those three that are actually not found directly in any plant foods human beings eat. So supplementation either with a fish oil supplement or with an algae-based supplement can give you the EPA and DHA that may be beneficial for health. So those are a few that I think are widely helpful. I think more broadly, you know, getting nutrient-rich food is the top priority. You know, you can get your calcium and your iron and, you know, from foods. You can get your iodine from iodized salt, can be a good source, or from seaweeds. And when you have a nutrient-dense diet that's low in the processed foods, you're generally going to saturate your body with the nutrients it needs.
And of course, with a sensible plant-based diet, you're also looking at helping your microbiome from the point of view of both pre and abiotics as well. So
that's right.
So from that point of view, I agree. What are your views on when you say plant-based diet? Where would you go to the point of view of my son is a well-researched vegan, and he's very much benefited himself and his family from following this course of action. What are your views over what you would call the ideal diet, even though obviously we all have our own individual preferences about, and also there's a huge amount of confusion over what you should be following?
Absolutely, sure. Well, Dan Buettner has led a team of National Geographic explorers who have studied what are known as the blue zones, which are regions in the world where exceptionally long, healthy lives, regions where people consistently live into their 80s. And what he's found is that in the blue zones, the populations in these regions all have certain characteristics in common. And, you know, they get lots of exercise, they have strong social ties. And they, when you look at diet, they all have a fairly similar, I mean, they live in very different places, but they all have a fairly similar diet in many respects. Most of them are plant-based, so they eat very little, if any, meat. And most of them eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains and legumes, and nuts and seeds. And so I think that probably that's pretty darn close to a fairly optimal diet for human beings. We know from countless medical studies that we need to eat less sugar, less processed foods, less flours, especially white flours, less bottled oils, and we need to eat less meat, quite frankly, as a society. And we also know that we need to eat more vegetables, more fruits, more legumes, more whole grains, and all of these things, nuts and seeds, are associated with positive health outcomes. All of these things are associated with reductions in rates of cancer and heart disease and diabetes and dementia and obesity. So when you look at the data, I think it's pretty clear the direction we need to move in. Now, as far as meat specifically, and let me say also that whole foods, plant-based vegans, and the paleo dieters actually have way more in common than most people realize. I mean, we're all mostly pointing in the same direction in many respects. And where you get disagreement is on the one hand, meat, and on the other hand, grains and legumes. And I think that there are a lot of paleo advocates who recognize that actually many of our Paleolithic ancestors did in fact consume some legumes and some whole grains, and who also recognize that there is fair bit of research, medical data that shows us that that many people do better and have better outcomes when legumes and whole grains are included in their diets. I think you also have quite a few vegans who are recognizing and vegetarians who are recognizing that for some people, a plant-based diet that includes some animal products may actually be the most optimal from a purely health perspective. Now, my take is that we need to eat less animal products. But whether that is zero or just less is something there isn't a one universal cookie cutter answer for this. Some people thrive on a strictly vegan diet when it's based around whole natural foods and they're able to get, you know, their needs for omega-3 fatty acids and a few other critical nutrients like B12 met, whether from supplements or in some other way. And then there are some people who find that a modest amount of animal products in their diet can really be beneficial. And I know some long-term vegans who added a bit of wild fish and they felt better and they felt stronger and they were more robust and problems that they'd been facing went away. So that does happen upon occasion. But for the most part, the direction is clear, I think, that we need to eat less animal products. And, you know, whether you want to go totally vegan and, you know, whether you want to eat more fruits or more vegetables or whether you want to include legumes or not, I mean, you've got to listen to your body. You've got to learn from your own life experience. You know, some of the factors to bear in mind are your metabolism, your own ethical sensibilities, your season and location, and what's available locally, your health history, your weight level, your health goals, how much you exercise, you know, how much mass you have. I mean, these are all factors that are going to impact what choices are right for you. But I think as a larger global community, the direction is quite clear, and the data backs it up pretty strongly.
I would totally agree. The one area that's grey from the point of view of if you look at a vegetarian restaurant, especially in the sort of catering industry, they bring in eggs and dairy. What is your take on those areas which are not really meat, but, you know, derived from animals?
So dairy products, dairy is a wonderful food for a baby cow that has four stomachs and wants to double its birth weight in less than 2 months of life. Milk is a wonderful food for the species that it was intended for. When you start taking milk and crossing the species barrier, I think it's a little more suspect, to be honest with you. I think that there is a fairly sizable body of evidence indicating that dairy can be detrimental to health in many cases. Of course, it has some nutrients like calcium and protein that can be beneficial, but it, sometimes the human body actually reacts to that protein as a kind of foreign protein. So dairy can be associated with autoimmune response. It can be associated with increased incidence of Alzheimer's disease. There have been studies linking dairy to higher rates of cancer. It certainly has an impact on hormone levels in humans that is problematic. It can cause premature puberty. It can because the cows are lactating mammals, and so when humans consume their milk, they're also absorbing the hormones of a lactating female cow, and that has an impact on us as well. So honestly, I think, you know, in moderation, a certain amount of dairy can probably be a part of a diet, and some people will do fine with it if it doesn't cause them indigestion or doesn't trigger an allergic reaction. But it's one of the first places to look if you're having any sense of allergic reaction or any kind of mysterious autoimmune diseases or such things, to try cutting out dairy and, you know, see what happens. I also recommend cutting out gluten and seeing what happens, not because everybody is allergic to gluten, but because some people are, and you need to know if you're one of them. So you can try that for a couple of months and see what happens. I know so many women who have found that their menstruations became less painful and easier when they stopped consuming dairy products. I know so many people who have found that their mysterious allergies went away, that suddenly they could breathe through their nose again when they stopped consuming dairy products. And as a dentist, I'm sure you know that mouth breathing at night is linked to tooth decay. And so you want people to be able to have an open nasal passageway and breathe through their nose. And that's one of these places where dairy products may not be your friend.
Well, and also, of course, you know, you're looking at lactose, which is, again, a sugar, and it's a fermentable sugar. And so I suppose, really, when you're looking at your grandfather's base, the two products, sugar and milk, which in fact, are, I suppose, really the most two antagonistic elements to our health. I think the difficulty is, as you know, is that, for example, sugar is in fact more addictive than cocaine.
That's right.
And so it's that weaning off process. And this is where it's literally, as you say, I think my son has shown this as well on his vegan diet, that when his friends were questioning it, he showed by example, you know, the fact that he was fitter, he was mentally more alert, his body took a new shape. And I think this is possibly where it's convincing other people by means of saying, look, this is how you can be.
Yes. Absolutely. You know, and we're seeing that it is as widespread as dairy consumption is, it is actually possible to really thrive without it. A lot of people feel actually somewhat addicted to dairy products, interestingly, along with sugar products. So you're right, ice cream is bringing the two together. And And I'm so proud that my dad made a different choice with his life and has helped so many other people to make different choices with their lives. And, you know, we could talk about eggs, too, if you like, for a second, since you mentioned, you know, please, animal products that don't involve killing animals. And, you know, eggs are, you know, there's just a lot of different ways to produce eggs. You know, I think that eggs can be produced by chickens that are clucking around in the field, and their manure is making compost, and they're eating bugs, and they can be a healthy part of an ecosystem. But at the same time, most of our eggs are coming from big industrialized factories where even cage-free hens never see the light of day. There may be 5,000 of them in one single warehouse, and they're so crowded that they go crazy and they try to peck each other to death, so the industry cuts off their beaks. And they're eating a totally unnatural diet. And I think eggs from that kind of cruelty are not something I want to support with my dollars or my pounds or my euros. And they're also not something that I want to take into my body. Now, so one of the key things there is what's waste, which is, you know, basically you want eggs from chickens that actually ran around, clucked around in a field if you're going to eat them. And those can cost more. There's kind of a premium for that. You know, I think it's worth it because otherwise we're eating products of immense cruelty, and that cruelty comes back to haunt us. You know, the meats that most people are eating today are coming out of factory farms, and they're coming from animals who lived in abject misery for their entire lives. And I don't want to consume meat or dairy or eggs from an industry that is based on exploitation and misery.
I totally agree. And I think even if you go to a quantum level and look at the energy that these products that we then consume often gives us, that negative energy that is based on the poor upbringing of the animals, the fear and distress they're under. So I think it goes to a very, very deep level.
It does. Well, you know, I just love that you're bringing this out and looking at holistic dentistry and holistic health and how we can heal our bodies and not with another Band-Aid, but with shoring up the terrain that's underneath everything we do. And food is truly the foundation of health. So thank you for helping us all learn and participate in again what I call the food revolution. If folks want to join us, you can join us. You can check out our website at foodrevolution.org. You can sign up for our email list. You can also go to foodrevolutionsummit.org to check out the Food Revolution Summit, where we interview top food experts and share their brilliant, breathtaking insights with the world. Again, you can sign up for all that at foodrevolutionsummit.org. I just want to thank everybody listening right now for all the ways that you choose to eat and live in ways that contribute to your health and to a healthier food culture for humanity. Step by step, one bite at a time, we are changing the world, and we're changing it together.
Ocean, it is my extreme gratitude that you could spend the time talking to us. I just really do hope that you may well, A, come to visit England and also be a regular speaker on our radio show, because you are making such a vast difference to so many people. Thank you.
I'd be honored. Absolutely.
I can see clearly.